Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1920, there were just 6 million cars on America's mostly unpaved roads, just 100-some telephones for every 1,000 people, and no one knew quite what to do yet with radio. By the time FDR was elected in 1932, radio was king. The years in between were a wild time of experimentation and outsized personalities. Dr. John Brinkley, Sister Amy McPherson, Lindbergh, bands, broadcast, boxing. This hour on Point when radio was really young. Joining me now is Anthony Rudell, author of the new book, Hello Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. You can read an excerpt from the book and link to thousands of old radio selections at our website, onpointradio.org. Anthony Rudell, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be with you today.
So I loved this story. Of course, I'm in the biz now, but there's so much I didn't know here. This is really before what we think of as the golden age of radio, 30s, 40s, 50s, before the War of the Worlds and Orson Welles and Jack Benny and The Shadow and the Hindenburg going down, Edward R. Murrow, before all of that. Paint a picture of the time you're describing here for us, Anthony.
Well, this is this amazing era when, after World War I, the government said, let's let people have their transmitters back, and suddenly radio went from being, you know, the crystal set in the attic to being a business. And it took less than 12 years for it to become the king of businesses in the United States. But this is really not the story so much of the growth of the business as it is the programming that went on. What they did with it, exactly how they reached people. And what I found so fascinating is that anything went. I mean, they would try anything. And one of the things to bring out to your listeners, I think it's so important, we live in a 24/7 media environment. Any moment of any day, you can turn on the radio, turn on a television, go to the internet, and there's something there. There's information there. There's entertainment there. Back in the 20s, radio stations signed on and off sort of willy-nilly. I mean, there was a great article I read in a West Coast paper that said that a certain radio station would be signing back on Thursday at 4:30 for 45 minutes because somebody was coming into town who could whistle the first act of Carmen.
Mark it on your calendar and tune in there because we'll be gone until then.
That's exactly right. They would just shut the station down and then turn it back on and start broadcasting.
We're going to look at a bunch of that programming, but I want to get a sense of just who had radios and who didn't. You said something already that kind of stopped me in my tracks. In World War I, radios were taken away from people. How many Americans had radios in 1920, 1925? I know the growth was very fast, but when did it really take off?
Well, radios were a hobby, and people had crystal sets where they would exchange, you know, at first it was just Morse code signals, and then some audio, but sort of gradually. World War I comes along, and the government issues an edict that says every transmitter in the country must either be under government control or shut down. And there were penalties if you didn't shut it down. In fact, it was challenged in the courts, but the government won, and they shut everything down.
Amazing.
So, you know, maybe there were 100,000 radio enthusiasts coast to coast, but it wasn't a big business. Then in 1920, the companies who are making radios and transmitting sound start to get into it, and that's when the growth begins.
And there's this wonderful discussion in your book of how the business, again, thought about it. They didn't really think of broadcasting at first. They thought of it as a kind of a big walkie-talkie system, or maybe a way, and this is where the Titanic came in back in 1912, a way for ship-to-shore communications.
It was ship-to-shore communications. It was point-to-point communication, much the way we use a cell phone today. They were trying to figure out how to send a radio signal from one train station to the next so they didn't have to run wires. And there was a guy named David Sarnoff who actually was one of the telegraphers during the Titanic disaster, and he went to work for RCA and Marconi Company, and he wrote a memo in the mid-teens, I think it was 1916 or 1917, in which he basically foresaw what radio could be, what broadcasting could be. And he said to his bosses, I see there's a business where we could do this, where we could use the fact that radio signals scatter, that they don't go point to point, that you could just tune in anywhere and hear it to our advantage. And his bosses said, yeah, no one is ever going to pay or listen to something sent to many people. He put the memo away. And then, of course, after World War I, he started running RCA
and became an absolute industry giant. I mean, that was a wonderful nugget in here. You've got Sarnoff back in 1912. News of the Titanic disaster flashed from the Carpathia on a Marconi wireless station. And here he is just a hobbyist, an enthusiast, and he's sending it on all over the country. And then you quote this RCA executive saying, "The wireless music box has no imaginable commercial value. Who would pay for a message sent to nobody in particular?" Ouch, that hurts. And he and he couldn't have been more wrong.
Totally wrong. And then, you know, 4 years later, they're in the business, and Westinghouse is in the business, and AT&T is in the business, and General Electric is in the business. But what was the business? I mean, one of the great chicken and egg stories is, why would you create radio programming if no one has a radio? And why would you buy a radio if there's nothing to listen to?
When did Americans begin to have radios in big numbers?
Well, the big numbers are really around 1921, 1922. The number of radio, the growth of radio stations in those early years of the 20s was incredible. It went from a handful in 1920 to several hundred by 1924, 25. The Commerce Department was inundated by requests for people wanting to put up transmitters or take their crystal sets and turn them into transmitters. I mean, radio stations were owned by all kinds of companies around the country. One of the things I love is that they used their call letters back then as a marketing tool. For example, WSM in Tennessee was owned by an insurance company, and WSM stood for We Shield Millions, which I just love, you know, and things like that. WLS in Chicago was owned by Sears, and that was the world's largest store, which is where you get WLS from.
Yeah, world's largest store. And this was a time when there were all kinds of firsts on radio. I love this one. You and others have helped us get to a lot of clips from this time. Here's one from 1927, still very early. Pioneering radio announcer Graham McNamee calling his audience's attention to the first time that music was broadcast coast to coast. And this is during a reception for the aviator, flyer Charles Lindbergh, after he returned to the U.S. from his transatlantic flight to Paris.
"And now the National Broadcasting Company and associated radio station, who are putting on this program by radio, are going to ask you to just listen to the band for a few moments, because particularly this is the first time band music has been transmitted from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast, which is another epoch. We will listen to the band."
Another epoch. The first time we will listen to the band. I just love that. I mean, it's hard to imagine that being a big, big deal. But firsts were all over the place in those days, Anthony.
The whole decade was firsts. And Graham McNamee, the voice you heard there, here's a guy who comes to New York. He's a church singer. He's looking for work. He walks into the studios in 1921, I think it was, or 22, of WEAF, which became an NBC station. And he goes in there, and he's looking for a job. The man needs money. And he goes in looking for a job, and somebody meets him and says, "Gee, you have a very lovely voice. Have you ever thought of being on the air?" And, of course, his response is, "Well, what does that mean, being on the air?" And Graham McNamee ends up creating the job of announcer in the United States. He did sports. He did politics. He did great events like the Lindbergh return. He hosted – he was the announcer on Rudy Valley's show. He was the announcer on Ed Wynn's show. This was a legend that we sort of have forgotten about 80 years later.
A legend kind of in the big urban center, but there were legends made in the middle of nowhere as well. In the middle of Kansas, you've got one of these early kind of huckster heroes of early radio, Dr. John Brinkley, who made a fortune with the combination of all things radio and goat testicles.
Yeah, it's a hard story to tell on the air, but we'll give it a shot. Brinkley moves to Milford, Kansas. He's earned his medical degree by sending $150 to the Kansas Eclectic College.
Yep.
And he goes to Milford with his wife. Milford is best known as being 10 miles from the geographic center of the United States. And that was all it had as its claim to fame. So he goes there. The rumor was, or the story goes, that his wife cried for an entire week after they arrived there. Anyway, he comes across a rancher who comes to him for a physical, and eventually the rancher says, "I'm having a problem."
This is before Viagra, before Cialis, but the same problem. And
the same problem.
I wish had as much gumption as my goats.
Yeah, well, exactly. You phrased that very well. Basically, he says, "I have a flat tire." And Brinkley, without thinking, says, "Well, if you had the equipment that your goats have, you'd be in great shape. So the guy says, well, put it in me. So Brinkley invents this operation where tissue from the goat is implanted into the man. And the story goes that a year later, his wife gives birth to a healthy baby boy who they named Billy. Now, you can't make this stuff up.
You can't make it up. I want to listen to just a little bit. Our time is short, but before you know it, he was working on prostate problems, too, and using the radio to sell it right across the country.
Exactly. And you men, you're holding back, many of you right now listening to me on these morning and evening broadcasts. And you know you're sick. You know your prostate's infected and diseased. And you know that unless some relief comes to you, that you're going to be in the undertaker's parlor on the old cold slab being embalmed for a funeral. Well, why do you hold back? Why do you twist around the old cupboard? Why do you lay longer and take chances when I'm offering you these low rates, this easy work, this lifetime guarantee of service plan? Come at once to the Brinkley Hospitals, Little Rock, Arkansas, before it's everlastingly too late.
Everlastingly too late. Come at once to the hospital there. Early radio speaking right across the nation. We go out of this segment with Eddie Cantor. 1931, big in those days. Anthony Rudell is with us. His new book is Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with much more.
Of love I'll whisper, so soft and low. Hear me calling, Ida sees, though, can't live without you. Listen, my honeydew-dee-doo, Ida, kind of idolize ya. I long to love ya, Ida deed, I doodle-doo.
Say, does my baby roll? Baby, does he roll? And what's more, more than four, nobody but me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the very early days of radio, when radio was young, when it was the new media. The revolution. There's the Boswell sisters with Does My Baby Love, 1930. My guest this hour is Anthony Rudell. His new book is Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Anthony Rudell joins us from New York. Let's just keep that sound in our ears. Here's your Graham McNamee again, one of the world's first sportscasters, 1927, introducing boxer Jack Dempsey in the famous 1927 match between Dempsey and Gene Tunney. You can barely make it out, but listeners did then, wearing black trunks, weighing 187.5 pounds, heavyweight king Jack Dempsey. What did it take, Anthony Rudell, to get America to tune in to sports on the radio? Were they there from the get-go?
Well, one of the very first boxing matches that was done on the air was 1921, which was Dempsey against Carpentier, and that sort of launched things. People suddenly realized they could listen at home, and that drove radio sales. So every time there was a World Series, for example, which would be every October, stores would run an ad, don't miss the game, buy a radio, and it would drive sales further. The three big sports that really drove radio were college football, and not the college football that we think of today where the powerhouses are, you know, the Alabamas or the USCs, but Ivy League college football. In fact, one of the first games broadcast was the Princeton University against the University of Chicago, which we don't think of as two football powerhouses today, but back then they were. So college football, baseball in the form of the World Series was huge, and boxing, thanks to Jack Dempsey, who was the king. He was the star. He was the celebrity. And anything Dempsey did made news, and therefore it drove radio. The interesting thing about it, they tried every kind of sport on the radio. In fact, I read one article in a paper that a local radio station was going to broadcast the local ping pong tournament. And I, for the life of me, can't imagine what that sounded like on the air. How do you call a ping pong game? But they tried it. I don't think it was very successful, but they tried it.
Humor, of course, came in early on. Will Rogers, famously, here he is. He started in 1930 with his humorous commentary. This is a little bit later, 1933, apologizing here, Will Rogers, for taking a break from the airwaves.
Excuse me for keeping my hat on, but I'm getting just a little gray, and I don't want it to show on the radio. Just one or two hairs in there that's got mixed in. Well, sir, I've been off the air here. I've been off about, I believe it's been about 7 weeks. I went off purposely to see if I couldn't give the country a chance to pick up a little. And I've been off 7 weeks, and it don't take much looking to see that I ain't done much since I've been gone.
Of course, 1933, the Great Depression was here. The country was in trouble. We'll look at Hoover and FDR and how they factored in, and they did, of course, radio-wise, in a big way. But let's listen to a little more here. Amos and Andy, one of the most popular serial comedies of those days. You wouldn't find it now, I guess. Two white actors, Freeman Gosden and Charles Carell, performing characters based on deep African-American stereotypes. Here, the two title characters discuss Amos's problems with his girlfriend in an episode from 1929.
What must I do?
Nothing you can do. I done told you, when a gal get ready to change her mind, boy, she changes. She don't mess around with her.
I wonder who in the world has done told her that I was talking to 50 Blake.
Well, in the first place, you ain't had no business talking to 50 Blake.
Well, I didn't talk to her. I was standing on the corner with a taxi cab, and she come up and started talking to me.
There we have Amos and Andy, a kind of blackface act on the radio. Anthony Rudell, what made it so big?
It was these characters became part of people's lives, and they began in the mid-20s on a local station in Chicago and then became part of syndication or national broadcasting when the networks came along in 27. And they something about their natural approach, the characters, just made the mistakes they got themselves into, the problems they got themselves into, made America want to hear them, and they were huge. They were the most popular daily show in the country, and they were on 15 minutes a day. They wrote all their own material. They did all their own voices. It was an amazing combination, and, you know, everyone from presidents to the lowest man on the totem pole, if you will, were listening to Amos and Andy, and when they endorsed a product or when a product advertised on their show, it was an instant hit. It was just
This is
so
almost
powerful.
Back to Al Jolson's blackface days. Did anyone take exception to the...
Yeah, there was one protest somewhere along the way, and I don't remember what year it was, but it was in the late 20s. There was a protest about them, but their popularity trumped that, and the stereotypes, the caricatures... were accepted and became part of radio lore. And the civil rights situation wasn't what it is today or wasn't even like in the 60s. So it was more accepted, and there was one protest at one point, but it went away very quickly.
Let's begin to hear from our listeners from Buffalo, New York. Alice. Hi, Alice. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In 93, our first radio was a crystal set, and radio seemed to open the door for us. Excuse me. I remember most of the music, the big bands of Bing Crosby.
And was it a big deal when that radio, that crystal set, came into your house, Alice?
Indeed, it was amazing. And to me, it opened a whole new world, and it's shows like yours today that keeps me in touch.
Well, we're always glad to hear from you. Thanks for calling, Alice. Let's get another right here from Bristol, Rhode Island. Mildred, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm 78. My mother left the farm up near Lake Superior in Michigan in 23. So this had to happen at right around that time that my uncle sent away for a kit to make a radio, and he would wrap wires around an oatmeal box or something like that.
Yeah.
And he was busy doing that, listening to the radio. And my grandmother came and said, "What are you doing here? You have to be out to the barn." Milking the cows. So, of course, he went out obediently, and when he came back, there she was with the earphones on her ears, listening to maybe WWJ or something like that.
You go milk the cows, and I'll listen for a while.
Yeah, right. And so later on, he became a really big-time ham radio operator and worked for the government during the war. But this was his introduction.
I love it. Thanks very much for that, Mildred. Let's get one more from Fort Myers, Florida. David, you're on the air.
Yes, I have an album that Alice Faye did, one of the first, you might say, pop singers of the time. It was called Alice Faye on the Air, and one of my favorite albums. And she made movies with Shirley Temple back in the 30s, and this was one of the first, as you would say, pop singers on the air.
Alice Faye, do you know her story, Anthony?
I don't. I mean, there were so many people who started on the air in those days who would do a radio show. They'd go to a city. Chicago was a mecca. People would come there and just sing on the air. And a lot of people's careers were launched that way, but I don't know the specifics of Alice Faye.
You know, we've talked about sex and sports and humor making their way into radio programming. Of course, religion and God got in there very early as well. You tell a lot of the amazing story of Sister Amy Simple McPherson, one of the first, maybe the first, big radio evangelist. Tell us that story, Anthony.
Well, McPherson was a Canadian, actually, born in Ontario, and she came to this country and began with her children and her mother a drive across the country where she would preach she called it her canvas cathedral in tents and do revival meetings coast to coast, basically. And she drove. She ends up in Los Angeles where she buys a plot of land and begins to preach. And then she goes to do a radio show at KHJ, which was owned by the Los Angeles Times. Many people believe that KHJ stands for Kindness, Happiness, and Joy, which just seems very logical for Los Angeles somehow. And so she would go to this station and begin to do it, and her popularity increased and increased. Well, pretty soon, Amy Semple McPherson was the most popular preacher in Los Angeles. She built a 5,000-seat temple with the proceeds from her contributions. Mm-hmm. And other members of the clergy in Los Angeles were very upset, including a guy named Fighting Bob Schuller, who also had a radio station with his church. Anyway, McPherson is riding high, and she suddenly disappears, believed to have been drowned in the Pacific Ocean. And the story goes on and on. It was front page news all across the country. Mm-hmm. Suddenly she's found wandering the desert, claiming to have been kidnapped. Turns out, as the story plays out over the next 6 months, that she hadn't been kidnapped at all. She was just escaping from the throngs with her paramour, who also happened to be her radio engineer. What was so great about reading the newspaper articles is every one of them said, McPherson escapes or in tryst with her radio man. And it was as if this were, you know, he were some alien. He were the radio man.
Exotic, huh?
And so her popularity peaked, and then she got embroiled in all kinds of legal battles over whether she lied or hadn't lied and then whether she was absconding with church money. And gradually she faded from the limelight. But she certainly was the first of the great radio preachers. And then, of course, following right on her footsteps was Father Coughlin.
Hold Father Coughlin for a second. We've got a little tape of Amy Simple McPherson here. I don't have the exact date. Sometime between 1925 and 1931, preaching here on the importance of faith.
Yeah. Faith! It has been said sometimes it has a trembling hand as it approaches God, but it must never have a withered hand. It must stretch and reach out and take hold of him. Just as a weak limb grows stronger by exercise, your faith will be strengthened if you will just stretch out and reach out and leap out and take hold of God. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah from the very early days of radio evangelism. And these were enormous, enormous stars of that time, Anthony.
Absolutely huge stars. And the power, I mean, we take broadcasting very much for granted here in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. But in the 1920s, this was all new. I always try to imagine the guy on a farm in some rural part of the country who goes to the state fair or goes to the big city once a year in 1920 or 21, and he comes home to his farm and he unpacks his stuff and he says to his wife, "Look what I bought." And he unwraps this thing with wires and tubes and a battery. And she says, "Well, what's that?" And he says, "It's a radio. I paid $75 for it." And she says, "Well, what does it do?" And he said, "Well, at night we'll turn it on and we'll be able to hear orchestras from New York or Chicago or Los Angeles or Nashville." And she looks at him and says, "John, you've been drinking again," because this concept was totally new. I mean, this idea that sound could travel into your home, into a box, and you could hear it. So you add the power of that magic, if you will, with the word of God, as Amy Semple McPherson claimed. And you have suddenly the pulpit with a whole new power to it. Mm. And that's what the evangelists discovered. And it continues today. Mm. It's not that different.
"Just reach out your hand," she says. And on the other end of the radio, she was there metaphorically to touch it. We're talking with Anthony Rudell. He's the author of the new book, Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. And, of course, it wasn't just culture and music that people got in touch with. It was the whole idea of hearing directly from newsmakers. We mentioned Charles Lindbergh before. Here's a clip after his 1927 transatlantic flight, one of the first major news events to be heavily covered by radio. Here he is speaking to the crowd.
When I landed at Le Bourget a few weeks ago, I landed with the expectancy and the hope of being able to see Europe. It was the first time I had ever been abroad. And I wasn't in any hurry to get back.
Charles Lindbergh, 1927. Anthony Rudell, I was struck there not just by hearing Lindbergh's voice and what that must have been like, but also the sense that listeners would have with that laughter of sharing in the response, a kind of a shared cultural attitude. They could hear how the crowd on the scene was responding and, in a sense, became part of that crowd, front row seats through radio.
That's exactly right. It transported you to the scene. You suddenly were sitting in your living room listening to these words, but you could see and feel and hear, even without seeing and feeling, what was going on. And you know, the one who discovered this really early on was Ed Wynn, who, when he did his first live radio show of one of his shows, they didn't have a studio audience, and it was ruining the show. And he finally said to the stage manager, get people in here. And they just brought anyone they could find into the studio, and then the show sounded like a show. So that live audience reaction, and it's interesting, you hear Lindbergh in that clip, how he was measuring his speech, because this whole idea of speaking into a microphone was entirely new. It wasn't just talking to the crowd in front of you. You suddenly had this invisible audience. So it really changed both sides of the equation, not only listening at home, but how you delivered your speeches.
We've got just a little bit of that right here. Comedian Ed Wynn's The Fire Chief show, Graham McNamee, served as Wynn's announcer and straight man. Here he is setting up a punchline just a little bit later in a 1937 episode.
Never mind that, Chief. What I want to know is, did you behave yourself?
Oh, what do you mean, Graham?
Well, I mean, did you keep the commandments?
Oh, don't be silly, Graham. I always keep the commandments.
You do?
Yes, my great trouble is with the amendments. That's my trouble.
I keep the commandments. My trouble is with the amendments. And we hear plenty of silly right there. That's wonderful stuff. Your story sort of builds toward FDR, in a way, but Herbert Hoover plays a huge role along the way. Begin to share that with us. He's no stick figure in this story. You've got Herbert Hoover, who was out in the Far East making his fortune in Burma, an orphan up by the bootstraps, right, pushing cartloads of gold in a mine after he got out of Stanford, but then as Secretary of Commerce, with his engineer's kind of mind and eye for order being very influential in early radio.
Yeah, this was, I think, for me, the biggest eye-opening thing in the research I did. We all think of Hoover, and we remember Hoover as the man who presided over the launch into the Great Depression. And when I started researching him, I realized that his greatest contributions to this country occurred when he was Secretary of Commerce under Harding and Coolidge from 21 to 28. And Hoover was, as you said, an organizational genius. I mean, there's so many parts of our society that he helped organize. For example, women's dress sizes, we were not standardized until the Commerce Department stepped in and standardized them. And so you have all these different things. And then in 28, he becomes president and inaugurated in 29, and everything seems fine until the stock market falls apart at the end of 29.
The crash comes, radio plays its role in all the politics of that time and understanding the crash. Anthony Rudell's book is Hello, Everybody. Stand by there in New York. We'll be right back with much more on Hoover, FDR, and the early days of radio. Here's Rudy Valley.
And I know that someday I'll discover her, the girl of my vagabond dream.
Hi-ho, everybody. This is Rudy Valley and company. The hilarious Fanny Bryce, the orchidaceous Tallulah Bankhead, the droll Joe Laurie. There's a trio that you can count on for a good time. Fanny brings her little hellcat, Baby Snooks, to an Eastern microphone for the last time before leaving for Hollywood on a new screen contract.
Rudy Valley in the early days of radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking back on those early days of American radio. We've got more tape, a lot of questions on the table, and so many callers who want in. Let's get one right here from Berlin, Germany, and Terrence. Terrence, you're on the air with Anthony Rudell.
Good day, gentlemen. Thanks for the opportunity here.
Sure.
I'm currently researching a paper on the role radio played in mostly the early 1960s, but clearly in the 30s and 40s, radio was very important in the development of identity in the United States. On the one hand, a national identity, thanks to Roosevelt's fireside chats, but on the other hand, individual senses of cultural identity. And I was wondering if you might comment on that.
Absolutely. Anthony Rudell, how about it? It's very interesting to look here at what whether the identity was shaped by technology or whether your sense, having looked into this very early era, whether it was just there ready to pour on to the radio or was it shaped by the radio or both?
Well, it's a combination, no question. I think one of the things that comes out very clearly, once you go to the national networks at the end of the 20s and into the 30s and as their power grew, America homogenized to a great degree. You had many more shows that were coming out of the coasts into the rest of the country. Whereas earlier in radio, there was a lot of regional broadcasting. And, you know, there was one, I remember seeing one article from the early 20s where a radio station in Arkansas was going to air on that particular Saturday night the local fiddlers contest.
Yeah.
And some radio station in New York decided they were going to carry it. And the image of a person in the 20s listening to a fiddlers contest late on a Saturday night just seemed very bizarre to me. But that was the nature of it. So there's a lot of the regionality remained in the local stations, but this national, you know, the national brands that were advertising, I mean, Rudy Valley, who we heard a clip from before, his national sponsor was Standard Brands, you know, and the various products under the Standard Brands
Royal
label.
Gelatin Hour.
Right. That was a little later and earlier before Prohibition ended. It was Fleischmann's Yeast, which is a whole story unto itself. But I think you see in what happens sociologically is that America homogenized more because everybody listened to Rudy Valley and everybody listened to FDR and so on.
Well, talk to us about Rudy Valley just as one example. I associate him with a much later period. Until I read this book, I had no idea he had a fame and popularity in the 1920s.
Right. Everyone thinks of Rudy Valley in one of two contexts. Either is the later context, which was how to succeed in business, or is the earlier context, which was sort of as this handsome crooner with the raccoon coat and the megaphone in the early 1920s.
Came out of Vermont and playing all around New England with went off to war, tried to, got a degree from Yale, played with the Connecticut Yankees.
Came to New York, leading the Connecticut Yankees, ended up playing in the Vincent Lopez Orchestra as a saxophone player, and he gets a job at a cabaret in New York, and they decide to broadcast part of his show, and he becomes an instant hit. And you notice that the clip before you heard him say, hey-ho, he was at the Hey-Ho Club, and that's where that came from. You know, it was, for example, the title of the book is Hello, Everybody, because of Roxy Rothafel. It's not all that, new. But Valley was this amazing man who understood the medium better than anyone. And he went on the air with his national show on the Thursday before the Tuesday crash of the market in 1929. He remained on the air in that time slot for 520 consecutive weeks,
wow,
which is amazing, with the same sponsor, by the way. But he and – go ahead.
Well, always Fleischmann's Yeast, you're indicating there that during Prohibition, maybe a little beer being brewed on the back of some of this advertising.
Well, it's funny. There's a letter, and I got to know the archivist who handles all his papers, and she sent me a letter he wrote in which he asked if his sponsor thought it would be okay if he sang the song OK Beer. And they said, no, it wouldn't be okay. So you couldn't even sing about it, let alone drink it. But he was a fascinating character. In 1932, he goes to his sponsor and says, I'm bored with the way I'm doing this show. I want to redefine what I'm doing. Goes on the air on a Thursday night Thursday night in October of 32 and says to the American audience, and I've seen the script, and as a radio junkie that I am, to see the script with his markings on it is just marvelous. And he said to the American people, tonight I'm going to present something entirely new. Why don't we call it Variety? And at that moment, the American Variety broadcast radio and later on Ed Sullivan, you know, that kind of show was created. So Rudy Valley was really a radio genius who we've forgotten about. as that role.
Yeah, and that period of his life, Terrence in Berlin, I guess there's a pretty good chunk of an answer for you, creating the path that led to Ed Sullivan and much more. Let's get a call from Lynn in Estill, South Carolina. Hi, Lynn. You're on the air. Hello, Lynn. Are you there, my friend? Lynn may have wandered off. Let's get another here.
Sounds like 1920s radio.
Yes, it does. Let's get another here from Marcy in Northampton, Massachusetts. Marcy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
Good. As you're talking about how radio changed, I happen to have had a cousin who was the owner and general manager of WNEW Radio in New York.
Uh-huh.
And she was responsible for two things that for many things, but two things that I think we would have time for. One was getting a reporter into the Hauptmann trial, which I believe is talked about in your guest's book. And the other is the innovative, forward-looking, which takes us, I guess, to the way radio works today, the DJ format. She created basically record playing on the radio. Her name was Bernice Judas. I don't know if your guest is aware of her.
I don't know the name, but
sounds like a great trailblazer.
Yeah,
well,
certainly a legendary station.
Well, she hired Milton Block and Willie B. Williams and gave Frank Sinatra his first paycheck.
Hey, that's a pretty good claim
and
to
she's
fame.
She's the person who snuck the reporter into the Hauptmann trial, put him in the closet in the back of the room.
Into the courthouse itself, a kind of news breakthrough there, not to mention DJ breakthrough. Marcy, thanks for calling. Anthony, I mean, here's more evolution in the hands of Marcy's cousin here, but just thinking how we can use this medium.
Yeah, the medium kept being used for newer and newer things, and what we look back on now, and what's fascinating to me is there's nothing really new now. I mean, a lot of people talk about American Idol being, you know, an earth-shattering new kind concept. It's the Major Bowes Amateur Hour from 1930 all over again, where people would actually call the studio and say which singer they liked most. So there's nothing new in that context. But in terms of the trial, I mean, the biggest news was in 1925 when a radio station in Chicago ran a phone line to Dayton, Tennessee, and broadcast the Scopes trial. And I would love to have heard that. You have William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow. I mean, it's better than any theater you could have. And so listeners across the country were able to listen to that trial in 25.
Does that survive, any of that tape?
Not that I've ever found. I mean, I've done some digging and I mean, there was no tape. It was all, disc capturing of sound, and the sound's never very good. But I don't think there's anything from that.
The Scopes trial on the air. What a thought. Let's go back to Estill, South Carolina, and Lynn. Lynn, I hope we've got you back.
Hi, Tom. Can
Hi.
You hear me now?
Yes, loud and clear. What have you got, Lynn?
Well, I just am thanking you so much for this show. I am actually on my way to a rehearsal with a traveling troupe. We recreate the old-timey radio shows,
mm-hmm.
and we perform them at nursing homes and senior citizen centers. And I am playing the lovely Margot Lane right now in the shadow. And it has been such a wonderful creative experience, but the people that we are doing these for really remember these programs, and so I can't wait to go get his book and read more about it. I'm younger than most of the folks in the troupe, and they grew up listening to the radio shows, so it's all new to me, but it is just sheer joy.
Lynn, you live in the middle of it and perform in the middle of it. What does it have that we don't maybe have quite on the radio today? What was it about that old-time format that still grabs people so?
I don't know. Well, you have to use your imagination, and I don't know. It seems like when you're talking about the Scopes trials and things like that, of course, those were the bad things, but these were lovely ways to just kind of escape things, and it seems like it was a simpler time.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it is just so joyful.
Well, Lynn, thanks.
And they're funny, and I don't know. It's just been a great experience.
We appreciate your calling in. Of course, the Scopes trial casting a big light on the whole debate over evolution. A lot of politics came on to the air as well. Anthony Riddell, you describe Herbert Hoover as kind of laying out the system for how Americans would get licenses and hear radio, that radio emerging in this country is much less government-controlled than in Europe. And then eventually Herbert Hoover coming around and very much using the medium. He'd had so much to do with shaping. Now, of course, the economy collapsed on his watch, and he went up against FDR. Here's a really interesting clip from 1932, getting toward the end of the period you focus on, in a Herbert Hoover campaign speech broadcast. And here he is, think of it in the context of this year's campaign. Here Herbert Hoover is discussing the theme of change in that year's, 1932's, presidential election.
We are told by the opposition that we must have a change, that we must have a new deal. It is not the change that comes from the normal development of national life to which I object or you object, but the proposal to alter the whole foundations of our national life, which have been built through generations of testing and struggle and the principle upon which we have made this nation.
Herbert Hoover, fascinating, 1932, and saying they're talking about change, and no, change is wrong. We want to stick with the good old ways. Of course, the country was tumbling into deep economic trouble then, Anthony.
There are a lot of very worrisome parallels sometimes when you look at it. In looking at the politics, though, what was fascinating, not only in the 32 campaign, but when Hoover ran in 28, is he accused Al Smith of being a big government Democrat who was going to raise everybody's taxes. Mm-hmm. We've certainly heard that before. But in 32, which is where the clip you just played came from, he was up against the master orator. I mean, FDR on the air was magic. There's a great line after he gave his first inaugural address that Lillian Gish, the actress, sent him a letter. And I believe she said to him, "Your voice was like phosphorescence." He was a great speaker. He knew how to use the medium. And in fact, there was a great article in the New York Times the night before the election of 1932 in which the Times predicted that Roosevelt would win because he and his surrogates were better on the radio than Hoover and his surrogates.
We'll come to FDR in just a moment. I've got a little bit of – you mentioned Father Charles Coughlin earlier, Roman Catholic priest, reached an audience of millions beginning in 26, a real demagogue. Became ultimately a big critic of FDR, but in 1932 and 33 was one of Roosevelt's biggest supporters. Let's just get that while we're in politics. Here he is lending his support to Roosevelt's programs, which were very controversial in 1933.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the day, despite all opposition to the contrary, that you remain steadfast behind the one man who can save this civilization of ours. It is either Roosevelt or ruin.
Roosevelt or ruin, with Father Coughlin there. Of course, there's a lot of talk these days about talk radio and angry radio. What's your sense of the anger level, the manipulation or demagoguery level then versus now, Anthony?
Well, the thing is, then it was all limited to radio. Whereas today we have it on cable TV, the internet, television. It's much more spread out and therefore much more obvious. The 1932 election, where Coughlin got behind Roosevelt, and of course it's very funny. As soon as Roosevelt became president, he realized the deal he had made with Coughlin wasn't going to help him, and he distanced himself from him. But Coughlin's power on the radio was unchecked. This man would go on the air and say things, and his millions of listeners – I mean, he raised millions of dollars by simply saying to his listeners, "Send me a dollar a year to be part of our group," and millions of dollars flowed into his church, to his parish. And he was incredibly powerful. But the anger level, it was – I suppose to a certain degree it was a little more articulate back then, but I don't think it was any worse than it is today, and that may not be any better. But the speakers were incredibly articulate. I mean, in 28, there was a group on the air that owned a radio station, WHAP, which stood for We Hold America Protestant, which went on the air and accused Al Smith, the Democratic nominee for president because he was a Roman Catholic, said that he would turn the country over to the Pope. And because of their right of religious free speech, they claimed they didn't have to give him equal time to rebut this. So
just take that, Al, and he did, and he lost. Our time grows short, but the parallels between this late young radio time and ours, not hard to see. Economic threats on many sides now, a kind of sense of crumbling at the moment. Everybody hopes it's not like the Depression, but they had theirs, and right in the middle of it, FDR, as you said, with his fireside chats. Let's listen here. 1933, the president, then the new president, setting out to explain the banking system and his steps to address the banking crisis in 1933, FDR to the American people.
My friends, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. To talk with the comparatively few who understand the mechanics of banking but more particularly with the overwhelming majority of you who use banks for the making of deposits and the drawing of checks. And I know that when you understand what we in Washington have been about, I shall continue to have your cooperation as fully as I have had your sympathy and your help during the past week.
FDR, 1933. Anthony, we've just got half a minute, but that radio became a real anchor and lifesaver for the nation as he used it to rally the country in the Great Depression.
Yeah, FDR was a genius with the medium, and he used it at its maturity there, it had reached its first level of maturity, to pull this country together. And that clip is possibly, that speech about banking helped the American banking system as nothing that has been done today has been able to do.
A little box in so many living rooms and parlors across the country, and from it, a voice that helped pull the whole country together and through an extremely tough time. Anthony Riddell's new book is Hello, Everybody, The Dawn of American Radio. A real pleasure. I learned a lot here, and so much we couldn't even get to. But Anthony, thank you very much for the book and for sharing some of it with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Just great to have you. Anthony Riddell joining us there from New York. I want to thank, in this hour, we had help putting together the sound for this hour from the folks at the website Old Time Radio Show Catalog, OTRCAT.com, where they've got thousands of old time radio selections available to listen to or purchase. We'll go out with Bing Crosby and Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Once in khaki suits, ah, gee, we look swell. Full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember, they called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember, I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare